Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Sherry Graydon, welcome.
Thank you.
What's the number one thing that you would like to have people take away from this conversation that we are going to have about our place in, for women in Canada and then women in the world?
That it is a profound loss that we are not actively engaging, accessing, utilizing, permitting women to contribute their talents, insights, energies, intelligence to everything we're doing.
As you say that, I can hear somebody going, what are you talking about? Look at the great advances that we've made in Canadian society. I mean, you go back to the 1970s, that only that far, and you go, well, the world is profoundly different, and especially for women in North America. And I would agree.
Absolutely, I would too. But I still think it's damning with faint praise because although, yes, things have dramatically shifted since the 1970s, on many, many measures, if you do the math to say, given the incremental progress we've made so far, how many years will it take until, for example, we have 50% women as parliamentarians? Mm-hmm. It's still going to be in the next century. So
the next century.
Yeah. I don't actually remember the math specifically for parliamentarians, but there have been calculations based on, the rate of change so far. We've been at about 25% here in Ottawa for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. So it's very slow. And although we look and say, well, you know, we have three female premiers. At one time, we actually had five female premiers.
We briefly had a female prime minister.
We briefly had a fabulous female prime minister. Mm-hmm. But it's still one step forward, two steps back.
So I appreciate and embrace the one step forward. What's driving the two steps back?
It's really complicated, and it depends on the field and the discipline and the environment. But take, for example, women in science and technology. There are all sorts of barriers that stop girls from aspiring to feeling comfortable in and staying in those fields. You know, doing math like a girl, for example, as an insult, right away from a very young age tells girls you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. Then you had the president of Harvard, Larry Summers, a number of years ago saying, well, you know, women can't do math. So these are things that have happened just in the, or are happening still. And that doesn't mean to say that there aren't lots of women that do pursue those degrees, but they get weeded out exponentially faster than their male colleagues because the environment, as long as it remains male-dominated, they still get sent messages that are sometimes explicit, sometimes implicit, that, you know, you don't really belong here, we're not going to make this a comfortable experience for you. And it's not always deliberate, sometimes mm-hmm. it's just the bro culture that is alienating.
So you spend a lot of time looking at how women are portrayed in the media. Mm-hmm. How are they portrayed these days?
Again, it's really varied. When I started working with Media Watch almost 30 years ago, we were focused specifically on how women were portrayed in advertisements and how sexually objectifying many of the images are. Mm-hmm. But for example, it used to be very common in business coverage of women executives for their clothing and their hair and all of those things to be referred to. And that happens less often now than it used to.
So why do you think that there has been a shift in focus from that, which I agree is a good thing, but mm-hmm. what is happening that we're now starting to say, okay, what difference does it make when you had a major corporation how your hair was done?
Well, I like to think it's partly a result
because
of the
of
kind
you.
Of work that I've done and many others,
yeah.
obviously. But I also think it's the more women you have in positions of power, mm-hmm. you know, Elise Allen is the president of GE. She's a really substantive, impressive human being.
Yes, she is.
To talk about her in those terms is it's clear how insulting and inappropriate that is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that didn't stop Hillary Clinton from being spoken about in those terms for her whole career.
But there was a bit of a backlash.
Lots of backlash when
that came out about Hillary Clinton, because they didn't say that her husband was wearing a teal blue suit. And yet people were still commenting about her clothing.
Yeah.
You know, when we look at the election cycle in the United States that included the defeat of Hillary Clinton, what we saw there was also some very disappointing, disturbing responses to her as a woman. Like, there was hatred directed to her because she was a woman.
No question.
It bothers me that we're still at that point.
As significant as the advances that we've made are,
mm-hmm.
it's very, very clear that the degree of sexism that operated in terms of the coverage and attitudes generally reinforced by media about Hillary Clinton's candidacy is still alive and thriving. And Donald Trump, in a way, made that even more dramatic because
mm-hmm.
he had made the many statements that he's made over his entire career that were denigrating of women, that objectified women, you know, we don't even need to go there. But
well, and he wasn't taken to task the way that I think that he should have been for making those kind of derogatory statements that were based solely on appearance
mm-hmm.
Rather than on competency.
Mm-hmm.
How do we then get to that point where we stop looking at the surface of, you know, who you are and at the substance of who you are?
Well, I think we have to continue to keep talking about it, and in a way his election has mobilized and motivated women and men in ways that I think would not have happened, so that's a very small silver lining in this dark cloud. But I think the more women who are in positions of authority and power and exercising significant responsibilities and are seen to be effective. So Angela Merkel, for example,
mm-hmm.
I don't think people talk about Angela Merkel's appearance. I don't get that impression that that's a big thing. And she is hugely respected. She's hugely competent. And so the more Angela Merkel's or Kim Campbell, I mean, when Kim Campbell was elected Prime Minister of Canada, there were all sorts of incredible challenges
mm-hmm.
within her party and so there are lots of reasons that have nothing to do with her or sexism that stopped her from maintaining that role. But
mm-hmm.
the more women there are,
yeah.
It's easier for Christy Clark now that she's joined by Kathleen Wynne and Rachel Notley, who are both extremely articulate, competent women.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think numbers do matter.
So when we talk about women in media and you're watching how they're being portrayed, how important is it that women be part of the decision-making or the storytelling process in talking about women, and how well represented are they within media circles to be able to carry out that?
So that's research I haven't done,
mm-hmm.
But I know anecdotally that, you know, there are lots and lots of women behind the scenes in television in particular. I think private radio is still the last bastion of male dominance in the media
mm-hmm.
environment, but it arguably has less influence now than many others. I think the impression lots of people have around women in the media is that, well, you know, I see lots of women reporters, anchors, so there's not a problem. I certainly hear that when I'm talking to people about the underrepresentation of women in the media. And so visibly, there are lots of women in the media on the producing side, the research side. CBC has many, many, probably more women in those kinds of roles than there are men. And that does make a difference,
mm-hmm.
not just in terms of how women are described or reported on, but the stories and the angles and the questions that get asked change when women are involved in deciding, you know, what focus do we want to take on this particular issue, because women's life experience remains profoundly different in some respects than men's. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, part of what I'm motivated by is to change not just how women are portrayed, but the actual numbers. I keep coming back to that. If there are more women who are interviewed as sources, as experts, it will change the conversations that we have.
So that's interesting that you bring that up, because I look at this program right here, and in the first 6 months of getting started, I maybe interviewed two women. And it's not because I wasn't looking. I find it much more difficult mm-hmm. to get women to agree to come on the program. And there's and it's partly because they go, well, there might be somebody who would be a better expert, or I'm not certain that I want to put myself out there for 20 some odd minutes. And so over the course of the last 2 years, I've been able to get to the point where I have an equal mix of men and women, but it is challenging.
I have a solution for you.
Yes.
and in fact, the phenomenon that you just described is exactly why I started Informed Opinions in 2010. David Mitchell, my partner, and I were walking across the parking lot of St. Patrick's Basilica in Montreal on René Lévesque. It was April 2nd, 2005, and the Pope had just died. Mm-hmm. And a TV crew, streeters, came up and said to us, because we were in the Catholic Church parking lot, the Pope has just died, would you comment? And I said, no, I don't think so, and kept walking. And David from behind me, who, and this is important, hadn't been to church in 40 years, he said, sure, I'll comment. And I turned around stunned and watched him bow his head and solemnly declare, it's a very sad day for Catholics everywhere. And as we continued on our walk to the Old Port, I said, honey, that was kind of obvious, wasn't it? And wouldn't it be great if the next pope were to come up with a progressive policy on contraception that wouldn't disenfranchise and marginalize millions of impoverished Catholic women around the world? And
right.
he said, yeah, Sherry, that would have been great. Too bad you turned down the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really painful, a reminder that, you know, I had already been working to increase women's representation in media. I knew that women turned down opportunities, just as you say, much more often than men.
Mm-hmm.
And often the words we say are, you know, I'm really not the best person, which is probably accurate.
Right.
But my experience, and yours probably too, is men don't go there. They don't, first of all, demand of themselves, I have to be the best person.
Mm-hmm.
They think, well, do I have an informed opinion? Yeah, I think about, read about, maybe I work in this area. Sure, I'll tell you what I think. But women have
right.
grown
and
up.
And sometimes it's not a particularly well-informed
no.
opinion, but they're more than happy to tell me. Frequently I have a woman that I've had to coax them to come on,
mm-hmm.
and they're extraordinary guests.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what were you?
Why were you so reluctant?
Yeah.
So there are all sorts of reasons women are reluctant. Now I've spent mm-hmm. 6 years talking to thousands of women, finding out why do you turn down, not just media interviews, but speaking opportunities,
mm-hmm.
other opportunities. And the short answer is, well, there are two short answers. One is, we're really busy. If you're a woman who's likely to be asked, the chances are you're at a stage in your career where you have lots of responsibilities. And if you have children or parents who are still alive,
mm-hmm.
you probably also have those kinds of responsibilities on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing.
Yep.
And women are very protective of their time. And if it's not clear that this is going to make their life or their families or career life easier, they're less likely to do it. But the second thing is that women know that they will be held to a higher standard of authority than their male colleagues, or at least they believe that that's the case, and often it's borne out. So they feel like they have to be really prepared. And so if you ask them to comment on a recent research study, and they haven't read the research study,
even though they may have worked on it 2 years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas a man will say, well, let me read the executive summary, and based on what else I know, I'm prepared to give you my informed opinion. A woman
mm-hmm.
feels like, no, she really has to have her ducks in a row.
Right.
And on top of that, if she is not wearing camera-ready clothing, if she has an inch of regrowth and she's going to be criticized for her hair or her makeup or lack thereof, she's not interested in going there, because she will get those criticisms in ways that her male colleagues won't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated, but that's why the project that I lead exists. We're actively working to convince women to overcome those reluctances.
Then also I think you add in the imposter syndrome that seems to affect women much more so than men. I look at the title of your book, Oh My God, What If I Really Am the Best Person? I find that women are far more reluctant to come to that point and say, yes, I am the best person for this role or for this position. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your book.
So the book is really just delivering that message, giving women who do know stuff all of the context, some of which we've just talked about, to say, yeah, you may not be the best person, but first of all, nobody's asking you if you're the best person. You need to approach this the way a reasonable man would. Mm-hmm. And the man is not asking himself, am I the best person? So don't let that be a barrier. And there are so many significant issues and perspectives and insights that if women don't speak up, will not be voiced. And the reason I tell the story about the Pope and David's comments and what didn't, David's comments made the national news.
And really all he was saying is, this is a terrible day
yeah,
for all Catholics.
Yeah, now they probably wouldn't have, you could speak to this better than I can. If I had shared my perspective, I don't know that CBC or CTV would have run that on the day the Pope died.
Hard to know when you're not there.
Hard to know.
There's so many different elements that come together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, at least in voicing that perspective, would have given the streeter crew some context for, oh, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, women, most of us, spend decades of our lives either trying to avoid becoming pregnant, trying to become pregnant, or dealing with the consequences of having been pregnant, which last forever. You would know that as a parent. And so if women's lives are so affected by that one experience alone, let alone all the others, you know, we're fearful in underground parking lots. When we travel alone, it's a very different experience. There's so many others. If we're not voicing our informed opinions, not just about those issues, but about all issues, about the environment, about the economy, there are entire swaths of human experience that are not being addressed in the way that they otherwise would be.
So if you're afraid to step forward and voice your opinion based on something that, as you have just pointed out, is fundamentally important to women, what does that reticence do in one realizing their own potential, either as a career person or in sports or volunteering or in parenting or whatever it is? If you have that kind of reticence, how does it then play itself out in other aspects of your life?
Well, it's hard to it's hard to know for any individual, because it'll always be different. But for me, what's as or more important is the big picture consequence of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because every woman who is a visible role model has potentially huge impact on thousands, hundreds of thousands of other young women or women who can then see themselves in that role. So when Adrienne Clarkson became the Governor General of Canada, she had young Chinese Canadian girls come up to her all the time, and a whole new world had opened up for them by virtue of her role and her visibility.
They saw the realm of the possible.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so, yeah, it has implications for individual women. You know, one of the arguments that I make with women is to say, if you turn down an opportunity because you're not the best person, you need to remember that the reporter who asked you to go on TV is not going to find that mythical best person, because first of all, there is no single best person, and secondly, they're not going to find them, so they're going to go to the guy in the next office.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to picture, or maybe he's across town, but it's going to be probably somebody you know in your field, and that guy's going to say yes. And he might be brilliant. He might be every bit as good as you. He might even be better. But the chances are that he's not going to be better than you, and you're going to watch him get the exposure and be seen as an expert and be given other opportunities. And you're going to kick yourself and say, well, I could have said that. I could have said sad day for Catholics.
And by not doing it, then we miss out on that perspective, which is completely different, as you pointed out in the example with David.
Yeah.
And the world doesn't get to see how we can address issues from a different perspective.
And that's huge, you know, when you think about the public policy implications of those conversations not happening. So one of the things I've really noticed in the last couple of years because of Jian Gomeshi and Bill Cosby and, you know, now the president-elect of the U.S., we've been having a much more public conversation about violence against women. Mm-hmm. But these are not new issues. And if women were more present dictating the angle, the focus, the emphasis being interviewed, those issues and many others would come up more often. That's really clear. We did an experiment. We took the first 100 commentaries, op-eds, that women we'd trained had written and published, and then we took a comparable sample of op-eds written by men in the same papers in the same period. We deducted the common words to see what issues only came up when women were talking.
And?
It's a heartbreaking list. A heartbreaking list. And it's so predictable. It includes words like abuse, access, costs, benefits, children, violence, treatment, women. I mean, it's so predictable. So we did that in 2013. We've just updated it. I'll send you the new new word cloud when we've produced it. And it includes words like water, safety, community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are not issues that men are not concerned about, but not as high on their radar, generally speaking. So there are conversations we need to have in this country and elsewhere that women's presence will
so
ensure.
To come full circle from where we started, we've made progress from the 1970s, but we still have a long way to go.
Long way to go.
And you are a force of nature. You have been driving this and producing results. And I encourage you to keep going. Please keep going, because we all will benefit from it. Thank you ever so much for doing
this. Thank you so much, Stuart.